Hey, y'all, it's me, Dr. Samina Ramon, Gyno Girl. Welcome back to another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. I'm super excited to have a special guest today. And I want us to think about how much more women are informed and more vocal we are these days. We're more engaged. I have patients coming in all the time. They've seen stuff on social media. They've seen stuff on TikTok. They are reading books. There's tons of books out there, but sometimes they still leave the doctor's office confused or, you know, dismissed, whatever. Today's conversation is really about changing the rules. And I often say on this podcast, my tagline is, I'm here to educate so you can advocate for yourself. And this is living proof. What I'm going to introduce to you is the Bible for advocation of all sorts of like women's health issues, not just, you know, reproductive, hormonal, everything. Today, my guest is the amazing health journalist and author, Megan Rabbit, whose book, The New Rules of Women's Health, is a deeply reported, evidence-based, and empowering look at why women's healthcare has fallen short for decades, probably more than that, and what we need to know to change it right now. And I love the approach that she's done. She interviewed over 100 different experts. She breaks down what the old rules are for women and how we're taught to accept suffering and all the bad things and what the new rules we are embracing. And this is totally aligning with my podcast because that's what I'm here to do. I'm here for you guys to be able to take information with you every time you see your clinician so that you don't leave even more confused. And so I love that she did this in this very expansive book. I think it's how many pages? Almost 700. This is really like an encyclopedia. I don't know if people remember what encyclopedia is.
I do.
Like, does anyone remember the encyclopedias of women's health rules? So today we're going to talk about what shocked her the most, the missed opportunities women face across lifespan, and how to navigate with the flood of information we get online and through media outlets, what's actually true, what she actually learned. So really it's changing the narrative on how sometimes we're viewed as difficult patients, but we want to become the empowered patient. We want to be able to advocate for ourselves. And realistically, I've said this before, like no one's coming to save you. So we got to do it for ourselves. So thank you so much, Megan Rabbit, for being here. I'm so excited. Such a fan.
Thank you so much. I'm right back at you. I am such a fan. Gyno Girl, amazing, amazing information for women. That's going to help us feel empowered to care for ourselves and get the care we deserve.
Absolutely. Well, let's start at the beginning. Like, what were the moments or series of moments? I mean, I read your, like, when we're talking about your intro, and you could tell us about some of the health issues that you talked about in your book. Mm-hmm. But what made you realize at some point, like, we can't follow these old rules anymore. There's some new rules that we have to follow. And why did you realize it needs to exist?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's like we have been left out of research for far too long, we being women, right? Yes. You talk about this all the time. It's like for far too many years, the research on sex-specific differences in health has just not existed. It has been underfunded, understudied. You know, when I really tucked into the research for this book, I think I realized that a lot of this had to do with women just not being at the table where decisions were made when it comes to what gets research, right? Yeah. And so because the men at the table, amazing clinicians and researchers, they weren't dealing with stabbing pain that's associated with all these gynecologic conditions. And so those didn't get studied, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's a whole bunch of other factors that we need to talk about when it comes to the sexism in historically in medicine.
Patriarchy.
Bingo. And so, you know, thankfully that is changing. And so the impetus for this book, the real spark for this book was I work for Maria Shriver. I was out in LA she, you know, I've been a longtime health journalist. So going on, 25 years now. And she looked at me and she said, you know, we have a long road ahead. We are not where we need to be when it comes to women's health research, but we do have some new findings, you know, based on the research that we are finally starting to do on women. I want you to write a manifesto. It's been far too many years since we have had and Maria Shriver is a commanding woman, you know. You look at her, I looked at her with wide eyes and I was like, okay, Maria, I'm on it, you know. And so I really started looking at the research, what we have, what women need, you know. We've got so many great health books, and so there are so many out there. But what I aim to do, I interviewed over 100 experts, all female, I felt like mm-hmm. that was really important to get that female voice in here. You know, for too long, we haven't had a seat at the table. Now we do. I wanted those voices in this book. And so really looking at lifespan issues, everything from anatomy, puberty, sexual health, all the gynecologic conditions, and then getting into some of the specialties, heart health, brain health, and really helping women understand what we need.
Autoimmune. I love the like the stuff around, you know, you did with autoimmune diseases and immunity and all the things.
Yeah.
So, you know, skin, you talk about skin, like it's just, it's a lot. It's pretty much, that's what I said. It's like an encyclopedia of like, okay, well, I'm having some GI. Well, what about multiple sclerosis or, you know, like we can look up certain topics and get, you know, a starter on some of these things and really get, you know, some answers that you deserve.
Yeah, so. Thank you. I mean, that was the goal. You know, this is a big book. And so it's not going to be one you bring to, it's not a beach read, right? It's not going to be one you cozy up with in your favorite reading chair with a cup of tea and go cover to cover. But what it is, you know, I had a high compliment. Someone said, this is a coffee table book because you want to be able to access it. It's really pretty. Yes. But also you want the men in your life to be like, what's that? Oh, you know, I've given chapters to my husband and said, look, I need you to read the breast health chapter because I have a follow-up ultrasound and I want you to support me in a better way than you usually do. And he found so much, you know, so much information for him that has helped him support me. And I think that's really important as well.
Uh-huh. Absolutely. Well, you know, my theme is I'm Gyno Girl is my like trade name or whatever, but so I love superheroes and I love comics, so I love a good origin story. So tell me like what brought you into the healthcare space as a writer? I mean, I think it's so amazing when people can translate, and you know, obviously as clinicians we try to do this to the best of our capacity, but we're not always like good at it, honestly. So, you know, and so I think that translational, you know, communication is so important for people to really understand their healthcare needs. But what brought you into writing and what brought you into healthcare writing specifically?
Yeah, I always wanted to be a doctor. So when I was a little girl, I thought I was going to be a doctor. And then I really tucked into a lot of science and I just felt like, oh, I don't know that I'm cut like out it. For it. I didn't. Yeah. So I always wrote, you know, throughout my life as well. It's how I processed the world, really. And then when I got to college, I took my first journalism class. And very quickly after college and I got my first job in magazines in New York City, the health beat was my jam. You know, I just wanted to cover health topics. I think it was because I had always been interested and fascinated by the body and how miraculous it is, you know? And so that was really my training by old school journalists who really taught me how to ask the right questions and translate complex medical topics into language that all of us can not only understand, but then put into practice in our life. And I feel like, you know, doctors like yourself, you're amazing at communicating with patients. And what I get the privilege of doing is asking you questions that, you know, all of us might have. And then really, you know, in asking you questions, doing the translation, doing the like, okay, I hear what you're saying, and asking the follow-up to help it make even more sense. You know, I often give the example of, you know, I was working on a story ages ago about why oatmeal lowers cholesterol. And I was getting all these like complex answers. And I'm like, just tell me how exactly it works in the body. Right. And I just love doing that because I feel too, like women are smart. We are smart. Yes. And when we understand the why, we'll be more inspired to do the thing you're telling us to do.
Absolutely. 100%. Yeah. I agree with that 100%. And, you know, and I love the fact that like, you know, as through writing, you're able to give patients voices, like you interview people with different conditions or like have been, you know, dismissed, unfortunately, by the healthcare system, which we can all agree is not meant to serve women in any capacity. Yeah. That is helpful, I think.
Yeah.
And so how has that been for you? Like just being able to go out and talk to like, you know, different patients in different scenarios or, you know, different things happening, COVID, all the things that were going on at once.
I love it. You know, because it's like, it's amazing talking to these mostly women. I focus a lot on women's health, right? And so I talk to these women who are dealing with conditions that make them feel invisible. So autoimmune disease, for example, you know, or chronic pain, which disproportionately impacts women. And a lot of times these conditions, you don't have the outward signs. And so you feel really alone in the struggle with it. And so I love talking to women about that, helping them give voice. And I think a lot of us, when we talk about what's going on in our health, we not only feel empowered, it's this extra sense of like, yeah, this happened to me, but we also feel like we're paying it forward. Because if someone else can read a story about my experience, if someone else can listen to a podcast like yours and say, that was me too, it makes us feel like we're helping other women who used to be in our same boat, right? And I think it's just, it's a real privilege. I consider it a privilege to talk to patients, to talk to physicians and researchers, to help give this information a platform.
Absolutely. And I think it's important because I have a lot of clinicians that listen to my podcast to understand, you know, that patient perspective as well. You know, that sometimes, again, I talked about this a lot in my podcast, that our healthcare system, when you have a 10-minute visit, it's not going to be fruitful for patients with really complex conditions or even transitioning through anything. And so it's like really so important that, you know, that we see the human side to all of it, right? Because at some point, as a burnt out clinician, and I've been there, I've been at a point where I had to see 40 patients a day, and it's, you don't feel good. You know, you don't, that's not why you went into this, you know? And so I always say that, like, I don't blame a lot of the clinicians, even though they could say things better when they don't understand and or when they don't have time. Sometimes I hear stories, I'm like, why did they tell you that? You know?
Yeah. And I think you're bringing up such a good point, which is like every clinician I interviewed for my book, they want to help patients. And so they're not trying to make people feel dismissed. And we're working within a system where appointment times are shorter than ever, right? Mm-hmm. But I felt really passionate about interviewing doctors for my book to help readers understand how we can make the most of those shorter visits. And there are some tips, you know, like I wonder what you think of this, but I have started doing in my own life, I write down a list of what's happening for me, the symptoms, and then I prioritize that list. So I rearrange the list and I'm like, look, this is all that's going on. I understand that we might only be able to tackle three of these things. Here's what feels most important to me. What do you think?
And I love that.
Oh my God. I have received, like, you can almost tell, like, the doctor's eyes start going like, oh, cool, we can have a conversation now, because I recognize as a patient their limitations with time.
Yeah.
And they also recognize from my end, like, okay, this girl knows, you know, what she wants to talk about.
Yeah. No, I love it. And in fact, I love when people come in with, you know, I've read this article, I read this book, what do you think about that? We can have, like, so many more fruitful conversations. And honestly, like, you know, instead of having to explain some of the conditions that they've already, like, you know, sometimes I'll have a patient like, I know I have provoked vestibulodynia and I read the book about sexual pain and I know it's this. And I'm like, sweet, let's go. Like, let's figure out. Because obviously, you know, once we start, you know, exposing the layers, it's true. And so it's really, really nice that people come in educated. I love that. When you interviewed over like 100 health experts to report, you know, what do you think shocked you the most? Like, what was most shocking for you to hear?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, there at every turn, I was surprised by something, which in and of itself surprised me because I've been steeped in health, you know, news for my whole career, right? And so, let's start with anatomy. There's a whole group of mostly female, but men are coming on board too, anatomists who are really passionate about stopping the use of anatomical eponyms. So fallopian tubes, right? Let's stop calling them fallopian tubes because they're actually named after an old Italian priest whose last name is Fallopio. Yeah. Oh my God.
I hate that too.
I had no idea. And so now I refer to my uterine tubes as uterine tubes, you know? And the cool part about this too, which also surprised me, but it makes sense, is that for those who are in medical school, you know, not using eponyms, rather, you know, some people call them anatomical toponyms, where it's like, you know, you're talking about the structure in relation to where it is, actually cuts down on cognitive load. It's going to help the people who are training to take care of us remember these things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's an anatomy.
But a Cooper's ligament or, you know, you're like, you're thinking about the, you know, scarpas, you know, all the things. And you're like, wait, why am I learning some dude's name?
Yeah, because they laid claim to a body part, like some explorer, you know, charging through our body way back in the day, right? And so that was surprising.
Right.
I feel like some of the surprising things that really impacted my own health and made changes, you know, prompted me to make changes in my own life. I interviewed Dr. Lisa Larkin, who said, you know, most doctors are not proactively talking to their patients about lifetime risk of breast cancer.
100%.
And sure enough, you know, I was like, geez, how did I make it to, I was 46 at the time, you know, 45. How did I make it to age 45? And no doctor has talked to me about my lifetime risk. Sure enough, I did the Tyrer-Cuzick model online myself. Yeah. I brought the results to my gynecologist and he said, Oh, yeah. This score combined with your category D extremely dense breasts means let's get you a breast MRI.
Yeah.
Changed,
I know.
You know, changed the game. And I think, you know, to your point too, like when you have a doctor who's really eager for patients to come with information, it felt so empowering. I felt like, cool, like I am taking charge. I'm owning my health in this new way. But it surprised me that a lot of doctors are not proactively talking about this with their patients.
Oh, 100%. I think what, you know, obviously, again, with the healthcare system, the way it is, we practice reactive medicine, right? We're not proactively preventing disease, which, you know, in this day and age, with the amount of knowledge we have around cancers and, you know, some obviously not enough knowledge around women, you know, specific diseases about, you know, how they impact women. But we have a lot that we've learned in the last, you know, even since I graduated med school 20 years ago, it's like we've learned so much. And unfortunately, if you're not one of the doctors that has the time or money or availability to go to conferences or to read on your whatever, then you become stuck 20 years ago, right? Like, and which happens, we know, in menopause, right? 20 years ago, nobody's given hormones, which I know the rhetoric is changing, which is great. But I think to your point, it's true. We're not practicing preventative medicine the way we need to.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just points to us as women needing to own our healthcare. You know, Maria has said something which I absolutely love, which is we have to become the CEO of our own healthcare. And it's fantastic, right? Yeah. Because it's like, think about that CEO energy. It's like you educate yourself, you figure out what, you become the big boss, you know, and when we can do that for ourselves in a healthcare scenario, I think we ultimately get better care and we feel more empowered. You know, this is when we walk out of our doctor's visits being like, oh yeah, right on. I feel like I expressed what I needed to express, you know, and got the care I deserved. You know, another thing I'm curious about your take on this, which really surprised me when I talk to young women, they're like, I have never heard this. Our gynecologic history actually impacts our heart health, your potential heart health risk later on. So things like pregnancy complications, even if they clear up after pregnancy, you might think it's totally in the rear view. Whereas actually that can impact heart risk or heart, you know, risk of heart attack and stroke, et cetera, later on. And that's 100%. Something we don't talk about enough, right?
Yeah. And 100%. So that's what I always ask my patients is like, you know, did you have preeclampsia? Did you have gestational diabetes? What did you have, even though you might not have it now? Because we need to be heart disease still number one killer. We need to really, like, I'm not a cardiologist, but heart health is very near and dear to me because, you know, number one, South Asians, like, you know, we carry a huge burden of heart disease, like we're 1/3 of the world population, but 60% of the world heart disease. So, you have family members that have died of heart attacks. My own mother died in a first heart attack. So it's like, that's something that I feel like we should be on top of for women. You know, we talk about breasts a lot, but not our.
We're all worried about breast cancer, and that should be on our radar, right? But you're absolutely right. You know, heart disease kills more women than all forms of cancer combined. And that is remarkable. And what really surprised me, again, something that shocked me, and I was so sad when I heard this, I interviewed preventive cardiologist Dr. Martha Gulati. She said, our awareness that heart disease is our number one risk is going down.
Yeah.
We got to fix that.
We had someone at the Menopause Society. I'm forgetting her name now, but she's a great preventive cardiologist who said the same thing. She was like, she showed us the studies and it was really surprising that people just don't even realize it. So listen up, guys.
and one more thing too, hot flashes. You know, in the menopause transition, all the women listening to this menopause transition, if you're dealing with recurrent hot flashes and they're bad, it is not a benign condition. Mm-hmm. You know, Dr. Lauren Stryker, I interviewed her and she was like, man, hot flashes are not something to just suffer through, or, you know, you have to bring this up with your doctor so that it can impact your risk of heart disease later on. And so knowing this helps us be proactive.
Oh, 100%. Okay, so your title is The New Rules of Women's Health. So what are some of the important new rules you think we should embrace?
Yeah. Number one, we have to own our health. You know, we have to become the CEO. So that means first and foremost, educating ourselves. We have to educate ourselves so that we can talk about what's happening to us in a way that's, you know, well, first of all, not even talk about what's happening to us, but understand what's happening to us. Know if symptoms we're having are normal or not, you know?
Right.
I think as women, a lot of times, I'll speak personally. For years, I ignored my own very should have raised red flags, menstrual symptoms, you know, heavy periods. Turned out I had a uterus full of fibroids, but because I wasn't educated, I hadn't, you know, what it was just normal for me. And because I didn't get an education about what a normal menstrual cycle is and bleeding, I just ignored it for years, you know? Right. So that is a big new rule. I think also, you know, again, across across every specialty, there's new rules in terms of how we need to care for ourselves in ways that are different than men. You know, we are not small men, right? As we are finally starting to understand and talk about more.
Or rats.
Or rats or cows or, Yeah, you know, and new rules for me personally, again, after doing so much reporting for this book and spending so many years working on it, is like, you know, getting into some of the nitty gritty. I broke up with alcohol. Man, that's a new rule for women. I think a lot of us have, you know, done the have a glass of wine or two to take the edge off. There is just no benefit, a lot of health risks associated, and I feel better than ever, you know?
Of course. Well, I mean, just think about the risk. If you talk about your breast cancer risk, sometimes people, you know, like are pushing the hormone. I'm like, I mean, it's just like, if you want to have alcohol, the risk is just as much as you know, being sedentary or, you know, whatever the case may be, or even using hormones. Yeah.
Yeah. I think another big new rule for me personally, I think for a lot of women, is I am really open to menopause hormone therapy when the time comes, when I, you know, I am already talking, even though I'm about to turn 47, I don't have any symptoms, but I am already talking to my doctors about menopause hormone therapy.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And I think that's something that's, you know, my mom, who's in her early 70s, she was part of the generation, as Dr. Kelly Casperson says, who is just denied hormone therapy, and she should be so pissed off. Exactly. And rightfully so, right? And so now I am more proactive about that because thankfully we're talking more about it. We understand more about it. And whether or not it's right for me remains to be seen, but at least we're, I'm proactively having those conversations.
That's great. Yeah. And I think, you know, just thinking about, we always talk about whether or not we use it for prevention or not, or prevention of chronic disease, but most people want to have strong bones. And we know that's a huge indication for menopausal hormone therapy. So, you know, barring any, you know, side effects or adverse indications, most women can probably, you know, say that I want to protect my bones, and they'll get them.
Yeah. And that's me. And I'm already talking to my clinicians about that. You know, I mean, I read a stat recently, 80% of the 10 million Americans with osteoporosis are women. 80%. Like, that is something that should be on all of our radars, right? You know, and how to prevent that fate.
Because nobody, as we always say in our little menopausal group, so we don't want to be, you know, frail and peeing on ourselves and not able to think, and all the things that we think of the majority of women who people in nursing homes are women, you know. So we want to, this is nursing home prevention 101, right? Like, so
totally.
Well, so another interesting, and you know, this is something I love to talk about as well, is really bias and systemic failures. And so that was sort of a major theme. And we all know what was it, 1993, before women were allowed in medical research, which is mind-blowing.
Federally funded. Yep.
Yeah. And so when we talk about the research bias toward women, how women were left behind, how did that bias show up most clearly for you when you were reporting it? Like, when you were, what are the big things, the red flags that you think of in your head when after all the interviews, like the most glaring biases that you learned about, that you were surprised about?
Yeah, I mean, when...
For so many.
For so many. There is. The first that comes to mind is autoimmune disease. It disproportionately impacts women to the tune of, I think, 70% of autoimmune disease patients are female. And unfortunately, you know, we don't know all the reasons why. You know, the next logical question is why. And that's the thing. It's like, we've got some good theories, and a lot more research is needed. So that is one area where so many women are really suffering from these conditions. And we, because we are so behind in the research, we're behind in being able to treat them, right?
Absolutely.
And so I think that's a big glaring, like, whoa. You know, Maria Shriver, who asked me to write this book, has been a fierce advocate in the women's brain health space, right?
Yeah. Alzheimer's,
the women's Alzheimer's movement. She founded that movement. She was governor of First Lady at the time, and her dad died of Alzheimer's disease. And what she said was that so many of the people coming up to her saying, you know, I'm so sorry Alzheimer's touched you, it happened to my mom, my sister, my aunt. It was all women. And she started asking, why women? And she was getting the very unsatisfying answer that we just live longer. And she was like, that doesn't add up, right? And so thankfully, we have a lot more information now. you know, and Maria, in her beautiful Maria way, was just like, well, if the research doesn't exist, well, I'm going to fund it. You know,
yeah.
how cool is that?
Her.
Yeah. And we have more women doing that, you know, saying yeah. we have a lack of funding there. Well, I'm going to fund it, you know?
Yeah.
And so those are two big areas that I think we still need more research. Luckily mm-hmm. we're making some tracks, but yeah, really it has a big impact on yeah. us, you know, dealing yeah. with these conditions that disproportionately impact us. And even the best doctors are like, I can't explain to you all the reasons why.
Yeah.
And that's really unsatisfying.
It's very frustrating, actually. I mean, even like, when I see my endometriosis patients or my patients, even with like significant fibroids, and you think, you know, if 80% of men had these tumors that, you know, a large percentage of them were bleeding out every month or, you know, were like significantly impaired 7 days out of the month or 10 days out of the month, like we for sure have a vaccine by now.
Amen.
Or something.
Amen.
You know, an antidote of some type, you know?
Oh my gosh. Totally. And, you know, it goes not only the research into the diseases, which is really important, but I recently had my first breast MRI. And when I got off that table, I was like, yikes, like that was, you know, it was fine. I don't want to, if this is in, you know, get your breast MRI. Don't, you know, but it's a little uncomfortable on your rib cage, you know? And the tech and I joked, we were like, it's totally a man who designed that machine.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced it is after having one, you know.
Come on, with an engineer. Let's go.
Yeah, but even something like that, like the more we have women and the more we take a female-specific lens into, you know, not only the research we're doing in terms of health conditions, but also medical devices that
Absolutely.
Are screening us yeah. for diseases and making sure mm-hmm. it is happening in a way that's more comfortable for women and fits our anatomy better. Like we're just behind, you know, and that's really just sad. We need to keep talking about it so that change continues yeah. to happen.
Yeah. And I love supporting women entrepreneurs. There's, you know, the group, have you heard of the Nella spec? It's like this
yes.
smoother. So, I mean, I'm a firm believer that, like, you know, if you approach a pelvic exam through a trauma-informed lens, then, you know, you're less likely to have a patient struggle, you know, but there are some, and, you know, I use like Pronox in my office, nitrous oxide for exams, even because I see so much pelvic floor dysfunction. But I love the fact that, like, you know, she was someone that had gone through all these, you know, miserable, awful pelvic exams and really suffered in trauma. And as a result, she's like, I'm going to do it. So I always tell the story now that I'm using her speculum. I tell my patients every day, I'm like, look at this. And it's nice and pink. Like, I like it.
Yeah. And isn't that the company too, where women can order it and then you get a kit yourself yeah. and you can bring it.
Kit.
Yeah. You can bring it to your
yeah.
doctor if, you know, and it comes with like cozy socks, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And just like things to make that exam yeah. more comfortable. And yeah. I think these are important things, right? Because we have a lot of,
right.
you know, we go to the doctor and it can be a scary situation. It can be fear inducing. It can feel like there's a real power differential in a good way, right? We go to you because you have so much more knowledge than we do right. about our bodies and can care for us in a way right. that we can't by ourselves. But there's anything you can do to feel a little more empowered, a little more confident yeah. in those interactions. It's going to help you be more open to saying everything that's happening, you know?
Absolutely.
And that's another big thing I learned. And another big new rule of women's health is like, we got to work towards dropping the shame we feel as women around our bodies. You know, when I interviewed a urologist, amazing urologist, Dr. Maria Uloko, amazing. She gives women a hand mirror for every vulvar exam. And she says, I can't tell you how sad it makes me when so many women don't want to look, they're ashamed.
They don't want to look. Most of them don't. And they're always apologizing about, you know, their pubic hair and they didn't shave and da da da. In fact, one of my friends and colleagues, Tammy Rowan, did this whole research study because as gynecologists, all we hear is apology. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't shave my legs. I'm sorry. And it's like the shame around your own body. You call it the hoo-ha. You don't call it the vestibule, vagina, vulva, you know, whatever. You know, it's like we have these names for it. And, you know, I make sure my girls know what they're talking about. But, you know, sometimes they get looks from people that are like, did your six-year-old just say vagina? And I'm like, yeah, well, is she going to say nose or eyelid? Because it's a body part.
Amen to that. Totally. I mean, that's the thing. That's what's going to help us drop the shame, right? Is because your little one is going to use words like vagina and vulva versus down there. And we're what is the difference between the nose or the eyes, or, you know? And it's like, yeah, I mean, I'm reminded of Dr. Elizabeth Coleman, who I interviewed for this book, who sits at the bedside of cancer patients. And she's like, these are women dying of breast cancer and they're apologizing for not wearing deodorant or shaving their armpits, you know? And it's like, I think you can speak to this. Like, every doctor I interviewed is like, we've seen everything. We don't want you to apologize. Yeah. Like, what do you have to be ashamed about? This is your female physiology. Like, there's no apologizing here.
There's no problem. Yeah. I mean, and it's funny, like, even when women forget tampons and they're just mortified, and I'm like, listen, we all are busy. Like, sometimes we're going to forget. And yes, you know, maybe it doesn't, you know, feel or smell right for you, but this is not anything that we're not used to seeing or, you know, dealing with.
Yes.
And, you know, the other thing I like that you highlighted in your book was really some missed opportunities at different stages in women's lives when it comes to, you know, the biggest missed opportunities of either advocating for themselves or, you know, understanding certain parts of what's happening. What do you think in different stages, like in your 20s and 30s versus, like, you know, perimenopause, midlife, what would you tell a woman that was, you know, to not forget these missed opportunities?
Yeah, I think when it comes to our reproductive years, you know, 20s, it's like, understand your menstrual cycle. Talk to your doctor about your menstrual cycle and get really detailed about what symptoms you're having, whether it comes to your period, your mood swings, or, you know, PMS. I feel like there's such an opportunity to talk to our doctors about, you know, and to get some education that we miss in health class or sex ed. I think sex is another big one. We got to talk about all the things when it comes to sex so that we're not stuck in our own little shame spiral about, like, oh, I should have higher desire than I do, or I should, things should be different. It's like, I should be able to orgasm as quickly as my male partner. Like, wow, no, we need to educate ourselves, right? And talk to our doctors about these things so that we have these opportunities to say, oh, this thing that I thought was normal isn't, and let me get care. Yeah. Or this thing that I have shame about is every other woman deals with, so maybe I can drop the shame, right?
Absolutely.
I think when it comes to midlife, which is where I'm at, which, you know, I am solidly in perimenopause, and I really now understand this time in my life as a window of opportunity. And I think we're talking a lot more about the symptoms of perimenopause and why we deserve treatment. And I think this is amazing. You know, we need to be talking about all the different things that can happen, tracking our symptoms, talking to our clinicians so that we can get the care we deserve. But I think it's also important to look at this transition as one of opportunity, right? I interviewed doctors who are like, gosh, we can't scare the younger generation out of, like, I feel more myself in a lot of ways. I feel like I'm giving fewer F's about things that are making me feel more confident and happy.
You know, the hair clock really took off. You know?
She is onto something with that, 100%, you know? But then when it comes to our health, I think understanding that at midlife, we have this real window of opportunity to double down on lifestyle habits that'll prevent us from seeing all of the ologists in our 70s and 80s and 90s, right? You know, don't you want to, like, and it's basic stuff, you know? I mean, I think that's the thing. I'm getting a lot of questions around, like, what's the one thing we can do? What's the best way to biohack your health? And it's like, honestly, it's such an unsexy answer, but one that I think most doctors are like, yep, it's like, stay consistent with the things we talk about all the time. Double down on a really good diet, get enough sleep, lift weights, and get your cardio in. You know, it's all these things we're hearing about, and it's like, start where you can, you know, start where you're the lowest hanging fruit for you and build on that. Yeah. But staying consistent with these things really does pay off down the road.
And the other thing I love telling people is just really, like, social connections and improving your cognitive fitness, right? Like, what's when, you know, you hear all these studies about, you know, so-and-so did a study on what brought them the most happiness in their life. And it wasn't money and it wasn't things. It was the social connections that they had had. Yeah. And so I think that even if you look at cognitive fitness and how we can improve our cognitive fitness, I think that's a huge one.
Oh, yeah. I heard from one brain health specialist who, you know, we talk about exercise as a really potent way to help our brain health over the long term. And she said to me, you know, do exercise, but exercise with someone else. You know, do a form of physical activity where you're actually socializing at the same time, and you get a double whammy effect because social connections matter so much, like you're saying, for our cognitive health. You know, I picked up pickleball throughout writing this book.
Oh, yeah.
And
I love it.
I love it because it's such great physical exercise, right? I'm sweating, but I have also made so many more friends, and it's fun. It makes me feel like a kid again, like I'm running around a court, like just having fun and laughing. And that social connection and the joy it brings me, it has impacted my health for the better in a number of ways.
Wonderful. I love that idea, actually. I recently just, because, you know, obviously the world's on fire and it's hard to tolerate some stuff happening. But so one of my dear friends that I've known since I was 17 lives like in Hawaii, and she does calligraphy, right? And she used to write me these really elaborate letters, and I would just never have time to do it. And now I've really locked in and tried to, you know, like get some good stationery. And, you know, we trained in a time when we learned cursive.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah, I learned cursive.
Yeah. So, you know, there's something about, and I just read a study on it because I was like, is there something therapeutic about this? Because I just wrote like 7 letters last week.
Love that.
But it's something about handwriting versus typing that really locks in your your mindfulness and like the physical sensations of writing and you know, really cognitive improvement and memory and all these things. So
I love it.
For anyone else listening out there, some of my old friends are going to get letters from me. So.
I love that.
But I did. I just told a patient, she's like, what else can I do? Because I'm having a lot of patients come in, you know, like forgetting to take medicine and really feeling the state of distress because of, you know, whatever side they're on politically or what, they're just, everyone's feeling some distress, right?
Yeah,
and so,
totally.
It's really one of these things where, and I don't know when this is going to air, but I'm sure it still will be happening.
I mean, yeah, it just feels like I saw a meme the other day where it was, you know, it's just like, it feels like dumpster fire after dumpster fire, right? And it can be really hard because it has an impact on us, right? Emotionally and even physically sometimes. And so it's...
Well, even when you talk about why do women, sometimes I think about how, you know, we talk about systemic injustices that happen to women, to people of color, to, you know, disabled individuals, to different genders, gender diverse people. And I think that there's, you know, good enough data that, you know, this whole weathering process that happens on, you know, the stress that occurs does eat away. I mean, we know that, like, there's, I interviewed this great doctor who looked at South Asians and why we have all the heart disease that we do.
Oh, yeah.
And it came down to enduring, you know, hundreds of years of colonization under the British rule, where we endured famines after famines, right? And so these situations that we deal with have a cumulative effect on our life and our health. So
absolutely. And I think it is such an important point, and one that I really tried to weave throughout this book, which is that if you are a woman of color, the odds are stacked against you. If it feels like you are up against more barriers, it's because you are.
You are.
and I think that is first and foremost important to recognize and name, right? And we have to talk about 100%. It because it is shocking that even well-meaning physicians have implicit biases that impact the way they care for women of color. And, you know, and what I tried to do is interview experts to be like, okay, so what do we do about this? What do we do about the fact that we have these microaggressions impacting our health, that discrimination has a real impact? And it's like, again, sort of, you know, start where you are, take, you know, have a health advocate, bring someone with you to your doctor's visits. If you're feeling like this is happening to you, have someone with you. If you feel like your pain is not believed, which can happen to women of color, unlike white women, bring someone with you and have them chime in and say, you know what, doc, the thing is, this is my sister. This pain that she's describing is not common for her. You know, just so that you can feel listened to more, you know, and it's like, it's not fair that you have to work within this systemic racism that exists. But because it's there, it's like, what can you do?
What can you do? I agree 100%. I talk about that a lot. Yeah. So I'm glad that you weave that through your book as well. Well, let's talk about one other thing is that, you know, there's so much health information, right? There's a lot happening on TikTok. There's a lot happening. And I, you know, I'm always out there trying to, like, you know, disassemble some of it. But, you know, as a person out there, how do you navigate, like, what practical guidance do you have for women? Like, how do we navigate if you don't know, if you don't know the evidence, if you don't, if you think that, you know, there was some trend happening on TikTok where my gynecologist can just scoop out my period. It was, I don't know if you saw that. And I was like, what? Anyway, so, you know, then people come in asking for these things and you're just like, what? So how do you talk to women about using practical guidance for, you know, their health?
Yeah, it's a great question because I think everyone can relate to the fact that we feel overwhelmed with information, right? Bombarded with information, misinformation, and not mm-hmm. really understanding where to start when it comes to sorting through and rising above and figuring out what actually applies to me. I think I feel really passionate about women knowing that everyone listening can become a health journalist right now. And here's how. Mm-hmm. First and foremost, what we do as health journalists is we look at the source. So you have to just do a little bit more digging. So it's like you say, okay, this is interesting health information. I'm wondering if it's going to apply to me. First, you look at the source. Who's saying it? Is there an ulterior motive, you know, or is this person? Or, you know, and you can find that fairly easily, sometimes not, but just do a little digging, do a Google search. Like, what is this person's qualifications? You know, why are they sharing this information? You know, I feel like so many in the menopause really are out there trying to be medical educators, right? You are trying to disseminate mm-hmm. information so that patients come to see you feeling more informed, right? And I think you have the chops to back it up, right? And so just that's first and foremost, look at the source. Right. I think then mm-hmm. what you want to do, what I do as a journalist, is you look for the medical consensus. You look for who else is saying the same information, or is this information coming from some, you know, influencer off the wall that nobody agrees with? Like that's another, you know, that's another thing. And then I think, you know, really a key part of this, once you've done that research and you're like, okay, I think this information is solid, it comes from a good source mm-hmm. and it might work for me, bring it to your doctor. You know, you say, look, here's the information I heard. Is this right for me? Because I think that's what we can't miss in our push to optimize everything and get all the information and be empowered patients. We have to understand that health advice that works for me based on my personal medical history and family health history may not be the same that you're getting from your doctor, you know? And I think that's really important. And it points to our need for clinicians that feel like true partners in our care, where they're helping us make shared decisions. You know, shared decision-making is a big, you know, key word that you want. You know, when I see a doctor, I want us to be feeling like, oh, we're having a great conversation. We're talking about this information in the context of my health, and we're coming to an action plan that feels right for me.
Absolutely. I love that. And I think it's what's important to understand too, is that, you know, a lot of people ChatGPT things and they're doing things. I mean, you have to remember like who's feeding the ChatGPT. It is still based on systemic bias, right? And so I have patients who are of color and they get different answers than my white patients. And, you know, so to me, that's a stark reminder. But I also think that, you know, with the amount of sort of like private equity and people that are kind of buying out healthcare, and pushing us to more of an automated healthcare system, right? This is one of the new things I've been thinking more about is how are, you know, this is, we cannot have cookie cutter medicine. We cannot, like, it's not one size fits all. And I do feel like that's one of my fears with AI and some of these other, like, you know, private equity people that are kind of buying up things and doing things. Because at the end of the day, it's going to become cookie cutter medicine, right? Like, it's going to be like, okay, this is our algorithm and this is what works and this is what's going to happen. And so that's why it's even more important, everything that you're saying.
Yeah, it needs to be personalized, right? It's just, it's why this, you know, trying to find the one answer, the lowest dose possible of exercise or sleep or whatever, you know, in this optimization conversation, I don't think really suits us, certainly not as women. And I think in general, you know, we really, I say this from a place of privilege. Like, I have choice when it comes to doctors, and I realize not everyone does, and we need to fix that, right? But I think if you are, like, if you do have choice, if you are someone where you can interview different doctors to find out who's going to take that personalized approach with you, who's going to really take the time to get to know you and understand what you're going through to help you land on things that feel really right for you, it pays in the long run to, like, do that effort. Make that effort now to find your people.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with you. Okay. So in closing, I want to talk a little bit about, so say a woman does read the whole book because she's like, I want to know everything about everything.
I love it.
What do you hope that she feels or does differently at her next doctor's appointment?
Yeah. I hope she feels more confident. I hope she goes into that, you know, gets in that flimsy gown and sits there maybe with a lot of nerves, but says, you know, I feel nervous right now, but I'm going to talk to you about what's happening to me and I'm not going to hold back. Mm-hmm. I'm going to talk to you about the symptoms. I'm not going to apologize for what I'm going through. And I want to know what you think. You know, I hope that that woman feels confident doing that, you know, because I think for a lot of us, we don't, you know, we might feel confident going in and then the doctor comes in and we're like, oh, we're like 5-year-old girls again, you know, feeling a little scared. And I think knowledge is, we say a lot, knowledge is power. I think knowledge is empowerment too. It's like when we have the information, not only the information, but the language we need to talk about what's happening with us. I think that's when we start to really feel empowered and become that empowered patient who can say, this is what's happening. Let's talk.
No, I love that. Yeah. I think that's one of the key things I would say that I would take away too, is that, you know, women, we're not asking for too much. We're not trying to, you know, we shouldn't continue to try to suffer and deal with things that we know that there's solutions for. And, you know, unfortunately, sometimes there's not a clear solution. It's not one thing, it's multiple things. And the reality is sometimes I tell patients, I'm like, oh my God, I have to do another. And I feel bad because it's like true. I feel the same way when I think about what I have to do. Like, oh, I have to do another thing to make myself like healthier.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I think we'll reap more benefit from it. And it'll be something that we should do for ourselves, like to be the CEO of our own health.
Yeah. And like, let's stop, not only stop apologizing for our bodies and our symptoms, but let's stop normalizing pain and suffering. You know, I don't know about you, but at my age now, like I kind of got the message when I was little, like, oh, suck it up. You got this. Like, buck up, buttercup. Yeah. Like, you're good. Yeah. You know, don't complain. Yeah. Be the good girl. And then I became this, you know, kind of the overachiever. And, you know, when we get into that sort of, you know, I think a lot of women can relate to this. We get into that mode. And we just start ignoring, or worse, I think we start, like, as Dr. Vonda Wright told me, so many of her patients say they wear, female patients wear their pain like a badge of honor. We brag about our high pain tolerance. Meanwhile, when we don't treat pain, it gets worse, you know, and we suffer more. And so I think that's another big hope, is that even if someone reads one chapter of this book, they walk away being like, oh, okay, I understand this more. And like, pain is not an option anymore. Suffering is not an option.
Totally. 100%. I love that. And I love everything that you're doing. And I'm so grateful that you were able to come on the podcast today. And everyone should go out and get your encyclopedia, your guide, your manifesto, as Maria Shriver says, the new rules of women's health. And so, and Maria Shriver wrote a very lovely forward as well. So I love
thank you, Dr. Robin. Yeah, it's exciting. You know, I'm really hopeful that this is going to help women. That's my biggest hope for the book.
Yeah. And like I said, you don't have to read all of it at once. I'm wondering about what I should do for my skin. Like, you can really pick and choose topics too. And that's what I love about it the most.
And give it to your husband, give it to your partner, your boyfriend, your son, give it to the men in your life where you're like, I need you to support me through this. And to support me means you need to be educated too.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Megan. This has been an honor and a pleasure. And I hope that we can meet IRL one day. Where are you looking again?
Boulder, Colorado.
Colorado. Yeah. Nice. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
You're Chicago. Yeah. I have a Chicago trip. One of my nieces who this book is dedicated to is actually at the University of Chicago. So we're going to meet IRL soon.
Look me up.
I will
meet up with you.
Yeah. So likewise. Thank you so much for having me.
I don't live that far from UFC. So
cool. All right. We're meeting.
Okay. Awesome. All right. Thanks, Megan. And I'll let you know when this goes live.
That's amazing. Yeah. No, hats off. Like, I feel like what you're doing in the world is so great. And it's just like, you know, as I think Kelly Casperson was on your pod recently, and she's like, we're not influencers. Yeah. We are medical educators. And you are, you know, you are helping us care for ourselves, you know, by educating us. And I think it's like, it's so good. More power to you. Keep it going.
And you're part of the team, honestly. You're part of the team. So we appreciate that as well.
Totally. Yeah. You got, let me keep me posted when your book comes out. I want to be aware.
Yeah, so. I'll send you.
Yeah, when you have a pub date. No, I'll buy one. But when you have a pub date, let me know so that I can help. You know, I'm happy to connect you with other media too.
Oh, perfect. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Well, thanks everyone for listening today and tuning in to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Remember, I'm Dr. Samina Rahman, and I'm here to educate so you could advocate for yourself. Please join me next week.
If
you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear. To get more information, my practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.